Greetings and welcome to a conversation with our distinguished President Emeritus, Dr. Robert Rutford. Dr. Rutford is an Antarctic explorer and scientist of international acclaim, having been recognized with the naming of the Rutford Ice Stream and Mount Rutford in Antarctica. And here at home locally on the campus of UT Dallas, one can drive along Rutford Avenue in his honor. He served with distinction as the president of UT Dallas throughout a very formative period during the university's 40-year history, 1982 to 1994. Thanks for being here, Dr. Rutford.
Oh, thanks for inviting me, Brandon.
You know, to start things off, I don't get too many Antarctic explorers behind that microphone, nor emeritus university presidents, and it got me wondering, which is tougher?
Well, two very, very different kind of tasks. The business in Antarctica is physically and mentally exhausting at times, and because you're at the mercy of, in those days, you're at the mercy of the weather and the U.S. Navy, who flew the airplanes and got you around. And because we worked inland, the only way we could get there was by C-130 ski-equipped C-130 aircraft. And if there were other demands on the aircraft, you were continually fighting to try to get airtime. The president time was quite different because you're dealing with a totally different group of people, you know, politicians and business people who are their own bosses, as opposed to dealing with a Navy captain who's got to report to an admiral. Mm-hmm. So they're quite different, but in both cases, very, very rewarding.
According to the American Council on Education, the average tenure of an American university president was about 8.5 years back in 2006, up from only 6 years 20 years earlier in 1986. Now, you served 12, and it's such a demanding position, and you presided over some rather momentous changes for this young university. How did you manage to do that for so long?
Well, we had great people here at the university to work with, Alex Clark and Stu Fallis and Priscilla Beadle and Sherry Johnson, who was my staff, and the people in Austin. This was when Hans Mark was the chancellor of the university system, mm-hmm. and Jim Duncan was the vice chancellor for academic affairs. And they were easy to work with, and they saw the potential of the University of Texas at Dallas, and we maybe got a little bit more attention than we otherwise might have, but it was a fun time.
And I'm sure among your colleagues, especially in this part of the state, you saw presidents come and go regularly.
Oh yeah, but I think there's a tendency in the UT system that 10 or 12 years is about the time it's just time to go.
Some of the highlights of your tenure at the helm include a steady increase in enrollment, a pitched and ultimately successful battle to establish an engineering school here and then build a building for it, the first on-campus housing, the admission of freshmen and sophomores in the fall of 1990, and we'll talk about these more in detail, but overall, paint the picture for us of UT Dallas when you arrived, and what did you know about the university before you got here?
Well, I knew a little bit about the university before I got here because Marty Halpern, who'd been in the geosciences department, was an Antarctic guy also, and so we talked about this a little bit. And it was known because of the history with TI and as a very unique place that started as a PhD university and basically worked its way down instead of starting as an undergraduate university and building its way up. So I knew a little bit about it, and I visited here a couple times before in the interview process. So when I got here, I don't know if I've told you, but if you went out at lunch, today when you go walk across the campus at noon, there's a whole bunch of people of all different descriptions and dressing and all sorts of things. Mm-hmm. In 1982, when I came, if you walked across the campus at noon, you might meet three or four other people, because the greatest number of classes were held after 5 o'clock. It was very much a commuter university because there was no housing, and the only full time students during the daytime were PhD students, and of course they were brown bagging and eating in the lab and eating their lunch at their desk. So it was during the daytime it was very quiet. And that causes some problems, and I might just elucidate that a little bit. We got a lot of heat from the coordinating board because our classrooms were empty, you know, between 8 in the morning and 5 at night. And one day we had plotted this and had a graph of it, and we also had a graph for several other universities. And it dawned on me that if you took the graph from the University of Texas at Austin and just turned it over and laid it down on top of ours, the fit was almost perfect because their classrooms were half empty or less from noon until 8 o'clock at night. And so they were not using their classrooms any more than we were, but they were using it in a traditional way, and we were using our pattern was non-traditional and very hard for people to accept. When we showed them the picture of the two graphs, we heard very little more about this classroom utilization. Coming from a big land-grant institution, coming from Nebraska and earlier than that when I was a student at the University of Minnesota, it's very different. Very different environment, very dedicated people, and research was the focus.
When you had that conversation with yourself that only someone looking to accept a job can do, what was it that pushed you over the edge to decide? Because you left a very nice profile position where you were, and you came and you took this great opportunity here. But how did the conversation in your mind go when you thought about this opportunity?
Well, you want me to be very honest?
Sure.
I was going to leave Nebraska. I was an interim chancellor at Nebraska, and the original five finalists were rejected by the regents. And so the two local candidates, Martin Massengale, who was a good friend of mine, and myself, became the two candidates as a result of the rejection of the others. And when Martin got the job, I was going to leave. Mm-hmm. And so I was out looking and had interviewed at the several universities. But the uniqueness of this place and the opportunity that, when you came here then, you interviewed with Eric Johnson and Cecil Green and the local people here. I mean, it was clear that this place had fantastic backing from the community, and not just from the local Richardson community, but from downtown as well. So it was I just saw it as a wonderful opportunity to become a university president, and I was very happy when I was named.
And then, as if you didn't have enough to do, getting to know your position here as university president, as early as 1983, shortly after your presidency began, the real push then was on to create the engineering program at UT Dallas. It would be 2 years before the Texas Higher Education Coordinating Board would give the go-ahead in 1985. After a lot of talk that the chances for an engineering school looked slim early on, tell me a little bit about the headwinds and the early challenges that you faced with this idea of an engineering school at UT Dallas.
Well, the initial push for the engineering school actually began before I got here. There was a famous regent at the University of Texas. I had promised Eric Johnson that UT Dallas, in the late 1970s, had promised Eric Johnson that the UT Dallas would get an engineering school. And he then died, and so there was no record of this conversation. But Bryce Jordan, who was then the president, and Stu Fallis, the vice president for business affairs, put together a proposal that for a full-blown engineering school with civil and mechanical and electrical. And that was submitted, and it was, you know, it had absolutely no hope of going anyplace. And was withdrawn finally. I'm not sure if the regents approved it or not, but at least it never went to the coordinating board. Probably informal talks were held with the coordinating board staff, and it was pulled back with the idea that, well, you were trying to bite off too much, and why don't you start small? And Stu Fallis had been out ill, and he came back as kind of a special assistant. He knew everybody in the community, and so he went around and talked to people, and he put together a group of five individuals representing Texas Instruments and E-Systems and Rockwell and Northern Telecom, and five guys. And so they just would sit around and shoot the breeze. And they were really guys that a couple of them were vice presidents for research at those institutions. And and we got the and talked to the community, it was clear. I mean, the community said, hey, we don't need mechanical engineering, and we don't need civil engineering. We need electrical engineering. So we put together a proposal for electrical engineering only. Mm-hmm. And as part of that process, we had NCHEMS come, which is a National Educational Research Center that's based in Denver. And they came down and did an independent interview with all of the companies here in Richardson and around the neighborhood. And that they confirmed right off that what the community wanted was a school of electrical engineering. We redid the proposal. We submitted it. The regents approved it. It went to the coordinating board. And just about that time, Hans Mark came in as the new chancellor. He said he'd like to review it. So they pulled it back from the coordinating board, and he looked at it. And he had the contacts with a number of people. And so he had an independent group of three guys come in, all of the members of the National Academy of Engineering, and well-known individuals who looked at the proposal, made some suggestions, but it basically endorsed it. Then it went back to the coordinating board. And it was touch and go, but they say, well, you know, there's an engineering school at Arlington. The guys at TI said, that's fine, but you know, we're an hour and a half from Arlington in 5 o'clock traffic. Mm-hmm. Well, it was kind of, you know, they said, well, you know, I mumbled and grumbled. And what happened was that Kent Black, who was the president of Rockwell International here in Richardson, on Thursday morning, I used to go get my car washed. And he would go get Kent's, he was a driver for Kent, chauffeur. And he would bring Kent's car down there. And we got to talking, and I said, Richard, you know, how long does, you know, you drive all over the city. You take Ken out to Bell Helicopter and all over and Irving and Arlington. And I said, how long does it take to drive from Rockwell, which is just, you know, a little bit north of TI, to UT Arlington? Oh, he said, I can draw you a time map. He said, not a mileage map. I'll draw you a time map as to how long it takes to go from A to B at various times in the day. Mm. And so, you know, that was kind of a freelance sort of a deal. But the thing that probably was the tiebreaker was that we got a couple of members of the coordinating board up here, and Kent Black arranged for a helicopter at 5 o'clock and flew them over, you know, down. We didn't have George Bush in those days, so everything was either on LBJ or 35 going down and across 30 and 20 to Arlington.
What a nightmare!
And these guys got a look at what the bumper-to-bumper traffic was like, and so they began to realize then that when you had TI with, at that time, about 17,000 employees, and Rockwell with 10, and Fujitsu, and all these other firms in what was then called the telecom corridor, mm-hmm. That there was a real market and a chance to start an engineering school in electrical engineering. And so they finally approved it, but with no money. And part of the approval was that we had to show, the university system had to show, that we had about $54 million in hand before we could start. And so we raised from the local community about the Excellence in Education Foundation gave $12 million. The local industry gave $12 million. The regents put up some cash and also a building and stuff, which counted, and so we were allowed to start. So basically, we built an engineering school with no state tax dollar support. That's the history of the School of Engineering. It was not an easy fight.
Where did the legislature and the governor specifically, where did they kind of come down on this issue?
Well, it never got to the legislature. That mm-hmm. particular decision never got to the legislature, because adding new courses and that sort of business is a coordinating board deal. When we came to add freshmen and sophomores, that was, the university was created by a legislation which prohibited freshmen and sophomores, and so that decision had to go to the legislature and the governor's approval. Mm-hmm. So we had, the local legislators were very supportive and of the engineering school, and some of whom are still around.
What goes through your mind now, nearly 25 years after the fact, this Herculean task of getting an engineering school here, when you look over at those two buildings along Rutford Avenue here on campus, what goes through your mind?
Well, it's kind of makes me certainly proud of the fact that we were able to pull it off. But, you know, as I said, we, because there's a whole bunch of people that deserve a ton of credit as to how it had happened. Mm-hmm. And certainly people like Kent Black and Ed Castile, and I could just go down a whole list of industry people who visited the coordinating board members, who lobbied strongly, who were very active. And you know, there were two reports that were done. One, when Stark Taylor was mayor, he established a lay committee of people to look at engineering education in the Dallas Metroplex. And that was chaired by Bill Moore, a fellow who's he's still in business. He's got an office over in Las Colinas. But he chaired the part of that, and Kent Black chaired the part on engineering. And when that report was done and issued, it called specifically for greater engineering without specifically identifying UT Dallas, but simply was a survey of what was needed for higher education in the Dallas area. Then Mark Shepard, who was president of Texas Instruments, he organized a committee. But Mark was he was something else. So he got all these guys in from Fort Worth as well. Mm-hmm. We had the head of the Fort Worth Chamber of Commerce, and at that time the guy who was head of the whatever that company is it called that owns Radio Shack, Tandy, I guess. And he got us all in the room over TI, and he said, now we're going to do this report. And Jim Fisher, who's one of his right-hand guys, Jim is going to be the person who's going to write it and make sure that it gets done. And if you don't think you can sign it when it's done, you should leave right now.
Is that right?
So that was, well, when it got down to the very end, the Fort Worth people began to drag their feet, and they wanted to change a whole bunch of stuff. And I said, my position was that we had all agreed that we were going to, when Jim was done and the basics were written, that we were all going to sign it. And so we had a pretty tense time for a week or two, but it finally was signed. And that was used with great emphasis, because here were the industry guys who were saying that we needed this school. And the fact that they put their money where their mouth was most interesting, and certainly that had a big impact also.
You talked about how in the early days of your time here at UT Dallas, when you go to campus, that it was very much a commuter campus, and you might bump into a few people during, say, the normal 8-to-5 type hours. But as that transition began to happen, where campus housing came about, and I wonder if you could tell me just some of your thoughts about how that came about and how it really sort of changed the campus.
The housing initially was strictly for graduate students, because the graduate students were the largest, most important pieces of the student body. The initial effort was to provide some low-cost housing for graduate students who might be married and have families and that sort of business. So the initial group for the student housing was aimed at them.
In one of the first newspaper articles I ran across about your first speech as president, you mentioned that UT Dallas was different from where you'd been at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln because you were accustomed to being surrounded by undergraduates at all levels. UT Dallas freshmen and sophomores weren't added to the student body until the fall of 1990. Why the long gap there?
There was a great deal of opposition to the freshman and sophomore addition. You had Richland College, you had a new Collin County Community College, you had SMU and UT Arlington and 4 years, other 4 years universities, North Texas. And so there was no great enthusiasm for UT Dallas to add freshmen and sophomores. However, there were a couple of guys in Dallas who basically said to me, we're going to go after freshmen and sophomores. And these were non-university types, Jess Hay and Peter O'Donnell. And they said, we'd like to, will carry the mail. And as I told them, I said, look, we just got this engineering thing, and everybody's tired. Mm-hmm. You know, we need to kind of let the dust settle. And they said, no, let's strike while the iron is hot. The local legislators introduced the bills, and what happened immediately then was that all the other upper division schools like Tyler and San Antonio, and they all wanted in on this bill also. So their local legislators added their names to the bill, and of course it died, it disappeared. Well, that summer there was a special session on the legislature for the budget, and the bill for UT Dallas reemerged and was passed in that special summer session, and Governor Clements signed it, and we were off and running again with no funding from the state.
It's starting to feel like a pattern, isn't it?
Yeah. So Pat Weber, who was then a vice president at TI and head of our development board here at UT Dallas, he and Sherry Johnson, in a very short period of time, raised about $3 million. And the building that we're in right now was provided by the state. This building, this part of the building, multi-purpose, was built as a first home for the College of Engineering. Mm. And the other half was built as an administration. The money, the $3 million, was used for, we didn't have any library books, we didn't have any labs for freshmen, you know, big labs for freshman classes. And so here in this building, and just down below, no, at the end of the hall, and down below was a big biology laboratory. There was a chemistry lab, there was a geology lab, there was engineering labs, and this building was basically at that time became a lab building with offices for the engineering faculty just across the hall from us here. We hired a dean, and he hired the faculty, and this was all hired for the School of Engineering on soft money. The same thing with the undergraduate, the freshmen and sophomores. And so we recruited the first class of freshmen, and we were pretty stupid. We didn't really stop to think about why were these very bright kids coming to UTD. And the bottom line was, after we finally woke up, they were coming to UTD because they couldn't afford to go to Harvard or Yale or wherever. I mean, they were really bright kids. Mm-hmm. And so without really thinking it, our advisors, and certainly I'm as guilty as anybody, we signed these kids up for 16 hours of class, and then later found out that half of them were working 25 or 30 hours a week. And another interesting thing that we found out, and I worry about this still, is that in those days, a kid could complete the required courses to graduate by the end of their junior year. And so a lot of kids just took basket weaving and other academic type courses their senior year. So basically they were for about a year, nobody had been, you know, they hadn't had to read and do math or calculus or whatever. And we signed them all up for calculus, and I can still, the one kid told me, I walked into class, a history class, the first day, and the teacher assigned a 700-page reading for the first 2 weeks. And he said, I didn't read 700 pages in the 3 years I was in high school. So that was the first semester was a disaster, and we learned a lot, and we got them, you know, charged up again, we got a slap from some of the local folks because we basically let that semester disappear. But I think it was the only fair thing to do, and it was approved by everybody. So it was not something that was done in the dark. It was something that was done openly, and we took the heat for it. But we just made a mistake.
In a practical sense, adding freshmen and sophomores changed the look of your walk across campus, didn't it?
Oh yeah, not initially, because there were so few of them. Mm-hmm. But from people who have been gone from here for 5 years, all of a sudden there are young ladies, you know, and young guys, and they're playing frisbees out in the mall, and it was just something that you didn't see before. Mm-hmm. So it changed and changed the university, and all of a sudden now you got freshmen and sophomores, and what's the next thing that comes? Fraternities and sororities. And various other groups on campus that you know, just kind of, that's just part of the environment. And it was, you know, I walked through the union today, and I see the students, you know, one of the sororities or fraternities selling stuff or doing things, service project, and it's you know, that's what a university is all about. It's easy to say that your education is dependent upon the faculty, but your a lot of your education is dependent upon the people that you go to class with, that you grow up with. If you're going to change your ideas a little bit, the input from your peers is essential. And many of our alums have done very well, as representing a diverse group that has graduated from here.
You were president for more than a decade, 12 years, in fact, and you've been a treasurer on campus now for nearly 30 years, most recently as president emeritus. Looking back over nearly three decades now, what has your time here meant to you?
Well, you know, this is, I suppose in a certain sense, I feel like this is my university, because the, and I say that without wanting to, you know, sound egotistical or stuff, but the character of this university that is that you see today, mm-hmm. it really was developed in those 10 or 12 years. The School of Management, which is now, you know, very large and so on, was really getting growing and beginning to make international contacts. You know, we had classes in Beijing, China. Classes in Russia. We still have in St. Petersburg a very, very close tie where we started helped them start a school of management. So that, and then the engineering school, which I think now is the second largest unit on the campus, and the housing. I just look at all the housing, and I told my wife the other day, I said, look at that. I said, you know, you just, when we did that first one, I had no idea. And you know, it's crowned by the dormitory at the end of the street, and it just is. It's, you know, I just look at it and think, you know, it was fun. It was hard work, but look at what happened.
And it brings you to campus what nearly every day still.
Oh yeah,
this
I'm,
love.
I'm trying to shed all of the paraphernalia that you acquire over the years and the. Books and papers and it's painful. You know, you look at these papers and it brings back thoughts of, hey, Wes, I remember that day and that meeting, and then you say, but there's a copy of it in the files, and you end up throwing it away. And
you've clearly left an indelible and positive mark on the campus and continue to serve the university. What is next for Antarctic explorer and President Emeritus Rutford?
Well, I'm winding down. You know, I'm tired, and we live here, and our kids, you know, there's ones in Chicago, ones in Lincoln, and ones in Jackson, Wyoming, and we see the one in Jackson, Wyoming, because we spend our summers there, but we're just trying to get to a point where we can, you know, have a little more flexibility. I'm a chairman of the Board of Trustees of a foundation, of the Geological Society of America Foundation, and so there's enough to keep me out of trouble, and you know, my wife doesn't want me around all the time, so I have to have some place to hide.
Dr. Rutford, it's an honor to visit with you, sir. I've very much enjoyed the time, and the exchanges we've had over the last several weeks have been meaningful to me and greatly informative, and I do appreciate you joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me, and I hope that it works out, and some people will listen to it sometime in the future.
This has been a conversation with UT Dallas President Emeritus Dr. Robert Rutford, brought to you by the University of Texas at Dallas and the Office of Communications. To find out more about the university, our special guests, or 40 years of UT Dallas history, visit us on the web at utdallas.edu. UT Dallas, creating the future since 1969. Until the next conversation with, I'm Brandon Webb. Be well.